My name is Frank Jones, and I'm an alcoholic. It's good to be here at the Cornhusker Roundup, and I would like to thank the committee for asking me to come and participate at your roundup. I love the enthusiasm. I love Alcoholics Anonymous, and I love what it's done in my life. And what I can say is if Alcoholics Anonymous didn't work, and these 12 steps, and the way things are going in my life, I wouldn't be here today. Because I'm a comfort creature. I like to be comfortable. And I like to feel good. And since I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've been with you people, and I've started working the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I got a sponsor, my life has changed and is comfortable a lot today. I can also tell you that I am not a member of ACA. I'm not codependent. I don't come from a dysfunctional family. I don't go to anything but Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. I'm a drunk, and I drank badly. And when I didn't drink, I acted badly. And when I acted badly, I had to drink. And then when I drank, I acted badly. And it was just a vicious circle. And I have no reason to be an alcoholic. I have no reason at all. Look at me. I don't even look like an alcoholic. I don't look like you folks. When I was growing up in Danville, Illinois, and I visualized and thought about what alcoholics looked like, I thought about the people here at the Cornhusker Roundup. But I come from a very loving family. My mother and father were fabulous parents. My father worked the same job for over 40 years. Him and my mother have been married for over 50. I don't understand those two things, long-term job and long-term marriage. I have two brothers. They're both sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. One of them has 5 years. The other one has about 8.5 years. I was fortunate enough to be at Alcoholics Anonymous when they got here, and I'm glad that I was. I had an absolutely ideal childhood. And looking back on it, if I could have written out a script for my childhood and how it was, I couldn't have written out a better script. I had everything going for me. I had a father that worked and a mother that was home. I played Little League Baseball. I played football, basketball. I run track because I was blessed with an amount of athletic ability. And I loved to play sports. And I didn't think I grew up with any problems. And when I got sober, I looked back and I seen that I did have some problems, but they were self-made because I'm the problem. You see, when I grew up, and there was a little girl next door, and her and I started playing doctor at the age of 6 or 7. And we started comparing the differences between her and I. I like the differences. Alcoholics Anonymous hasn't changed that. I still like the differences. But what happened was I grew up in a good home, and I knew right from wrong, and I knew about the Ten Commandments, and I knew the things that her and I were doing were wrong. But, you know, I didn't care. It felt good, so I kept doing it. And I stuffed the guilt. And I grew up also during the era of John Wayne and Wild Bill Hickok and Lash LaRue and all these macho guys. And, you know, when I was growing up, all I wanted to do was fit in with you guys. And I just wanted to be a part of that clique. I just wanted to be a part of that crowd and fit in with you that you've heard other people say up here. And I wanted to fit in, and I never felt I fit in. You know, growing up, I felt like I was better than them, or I felt like I was less than them. I never felt even with them, and I don't know where that come from. You know, growing up also, I had a problem with perfectionism. And I know you can't tell that, but I had a problem with perfectionism. You know, I could walk around, and I do it today, and I try not to. My wife tried to help cure me of that. I can spot dust and lint on the carpet at 50 feet. And I walk around, and I pick up these little fuzz balls, and I say, how come all this stuff is on the floor? And she tells me, why are you always looking down? I can't answer those questions. So I quit looking down. I started walking around the house looking up, seeing the cobwebs in the corners. But you know, this perfectionism got me in a lot of trouble. And when you're playing doctor with a little girl next door and you're trying to be macho and tough, you ain't got anything to offer her at the age I was when I started doing that. So I started ironing my underwear. And I started ironing the sheets that I slept on. So I did those kind of things growing up that were never forced on me. And like I said, I grew up and I wanted to be a part of the crowd. And I grew up when the macho guys were on the silver screen. But you know, I was frightened growing up. I was afraid of you guys. I wanted to fit in with you, but I didn't want you to get too close to me because I had some secrets. You see, growing up, I was a liar and a cheat and a thief. My parents never taught me to steal. The people that I was hanging out with didn't teach me to steal. They didn't teach me to lie and cheat, but I did those things. And I didn't want you to find out about them because I wanted you to like me. And so I would continue to do those things, and I'd stuff those feelings down inside me. And when you got too close to me, I'd push you away. And what happened was I became a fighter. And, I mean, look at me. I'm trying to be macho, and I look like Mr. Peepers, for Christ's sake. Mr. Peepers isn't macho. But I got in these fights, you know, and I didn't want to hurt you. And I didn't want you to hurt me. And I started hanging out when I left basketball practice or football practice. I'd go down on Main Street in Danville. And down there in Danville, down on Main Street is where all the guys hung out that I wanted to be like because they looked cool. These guys had on black leather jackets. These guys had ducktail haircuts. These guys had long sideburns. They wore engineer boots and they wore Levi's. And I liked that and I wanted to hang out with them, but they scared me. And when they scared me, I'd have to fight to get them away from me because I didn't want them to find out about me. You see, also, I was afraid of the dark, and I couldn't tell anybody that when I was growing up. I was ashamed of that. And so when they'd get close to me, I'd have to keep them away, and I'd have to fight them. And I'm too light to fight and too thin to win, for Christ's sakes. So I developed the technique of ambush. And I started hitting people with bricks and clubs and sticks to keep them away from me and to win the fight. And then I'd go home at night, and I'd think about the guy I hit in the face with a brick, and I felt bad for him. Now, I can't be macho and feel bad for somebody. I'd have to suck it up and act tough. And I had those feelings of guilt and remorse. And I had to push those feelings of remorse and guilt down inside me because I didn't want to face those things and I couldn't handle those emotions. And that's how I grew up, with all those feelings and emotions that I couldn't deal with. And I never stopped and thought about it and think, hey, Jones, you know what? In 1989, you'll be in Nebraska speaking. You better remember this stuff. I didn't take notes on it. What I did was I just kept living that way. And, you know, I continued to fight. And when you grow up, the bigger you get, the fights get worse. And I started getting into some trouble. And I'd go play ball and stuff, and I'd still fight and get carried away. And I wasn't even drinking yet. And, you know, I was at a party one day back there in Danville, and it was a hot summer night back there. It was about 110, and it was humid. And I was with my girlfriend, and she brought me over a big 16-ounce tea glass full of slow gin and 7-Up. And she handed that to me, and I hadn't drank. I didn't know what that stuff was. And I took a sip of it, and it tasted like strawberry Kool-Aid. And so I chug-a-lugged that glass down. That was no big deal. And I got to tell you, nothing happened. You know, it didn't get down into my stomach. I didn't get all warm and fuzzy. That didn't happen. I didn't get 6'4" and weigh 220 pounds. What happened was, is I did what I was going to do for a long time after that. I bossed her around. And I told her, go get me another one, and she did. And she, you know, she brought me another 16-ounce tea glass full of slow gin and 7-Up. And, you know, I drank that down. And, you know, I didn't cross some invisible line after that second glass. I didn't put on a trench coat and get a bottle of wine and put it in a paper bag and go hang out on Skid Row. That didn't happen to me. You know, nothing happened. I didn't think it was a big deal. You know, I drank about a gallon of that stuff in 30 minutes. Nothing happened. I just didn't think it was important, and I didn't think about it. And I can tell you this, about 35, 40 minutes after that last glass, I found out where slow gin got its name. I got drunk as hell. Yeah, went into a blackout. Didn't know that. What happened was I got very sick. And I got taken home by some of my partners, some of the guys I wanted to fit in with. They took me home and they dropped me off. And you know, the next morning when I come to, I was vomiting and my stomach was upset and I had a headache and it was throbbing and beating. And I was sicker than a dog and I didn't know what in the hell done it. And my mom and dad was yelling at me and I was in a lot of trouble. You see, I wasn't raised to be that way or do those things because I knew about the Ten Commandments and God. I'd been raised in a good home and I was a jock. I was playing ball. For Christ's sakes, I won 9 letters in high school. But I was sicker than a dog, and they were yelling and screaming at me. And, you know, I missed 3 days of school because I had a hangover. And I didn't know that. And, you know, I went back to school after missing 3 days, and I got with my buddies. And they told me what I had done that night, and I didn't remember any of it. They told me that I was out there dancing. And I don't dance. I think dancing is a waste of motion. I'm usually playing doctor somewhere. I don't dance. I don't dance in AA. I think it's a waste of motion. Well, I dance with my wife. But, you know, they told me that this guy come up to me and he lipped off and they said I punched him in the face and he went through the screen door. And, you know, all these things. You know, I couldn't remember any of them. And I didn't know until I got here with you what a blackout is. You know, I don't know if any of you people had those things. See, you don't know, I don't know how you drank. I just know that I found out what a blackout was here with you. That Frank Jones could consume amounts of alcohol. And when I did that, I would continue to function and do the things I was doing. But the next morning when I woke up, I couldn't remember them. Any of you have that happen to you? It sure happened to me. I couldn't remember that night, and I didn't know then what I know now, that that's a sign that I may have a problem drinking. You know, I didn't know that, and I didn't even think about it anymore. It did teach me one thing, though, and I'll tell you that. From that day, that summer day in Danville, Illinois, to the day I stand here before you tonight, right now, I have never, ever drank in 7-Up again. I don't drink it. That stuff makes me crazy. I can't remember the night before. I'm sick. I throw up the next day, so I just don't drink 7-Up. That was the answer. I was denying that from the word go. Alcoholism is a disease of denial, and I was denying it. I thought 7-Up caused all that. I say 7-Up today, and it kind of makes my stomach turn. But, you know, I didn't turn into a blazing alcoholic then, and I didn't go out and get the shakes and have to have a drink after that. I had some beers with the football team, and I kept fighting and everything. And I kept doing the things I was doing. I kept the lying, the cheating, the stealing, and all these feelings and emotions I stuffed down because I was ashamed. And, you know, finally all my buddies and everything and my girlfriend, they were talking about going to college. And they were talking about what they were going to major in and what they were going to do when they grow up. And, you know, I didn't know what I was going to do. They were talking about what vocation they were going into. And, you know, I was too ashamed to tell them that I didn't know what the word vocation meant. I was ashamed of that. You see, I wasn't interested in learning anything in high school. I thought I had all the answers. I was a know-it-all. You know, I thought I knew everything, and I was interested in being cool and being slick and running with the girls and playing sports. So I didn't know what vocation was, and, you know, I had a couple of scholarship offers to go play ball, and that scared me because I had a lot of fear, and I couldn't tell anybody that, and I was still fighting and getting in trouble. And what happened was is if you're macho and tough like I am and you're afraid and you don't know what you're going to be when you grow up, I did what macho tough guys do at the age of 17, and 2 weeks before graduation, I quit high school. And my parents went crazy. And I went home, and I went down, and I did what macho guys do. You see, I got to be macho and tough. I don't want you to think I'm a wimp and a wuss, because I don't ever want to be that. I want to be tough, so I did what tough guys do. I went down and joined the Marine Corps. And that's macho and tough. See, wimps and wussies don't join the Marine Corps. And I didn't think my dad had signed the papers for me, and when I got home, he signed those papers so quick it made my head swim. I found myself on a train going up to Chicago, and I'm sitting next to the guy that I want to be like. This guy's got a greasy ducktail haircut. He's got long sideburns, and he's got that leather jacket on. He's got on engineer boots, and this guy looks cool. And I want to be like him. I want to feel inside the way this guy looks. God, I want to feel that. And he's drinking his stuff out of a little brown bottle, and he pokes me, and he says, "Hey, man, you want to hit off of this?" And I tell him, "Sure." And I take two or three big mouthfuls of that, and I swallow it down. Now, I don't know what you did when you were 17-year-old when you chug-a-lugged whiskey. I'll tell you what I did. I threw that crap right back up. And I'm sitting there, and my eyes are watering, and I got snot running out of my nose, and I don't look macho. You cannot look macho with snot running out of your nose and tears coming out of your eyes. And I got to tell you how bad I wanted to fit in with this guy. I wiped off my face, handed him that bottle back, and I said, "Boy, that was good." You see, I wanted him to like me. I wanted to fit in with him. I don't know if you ever wanted to fit in, but God, I wanted to fit in with him. He said, "You want another drink?" And I said, "No, not right now." I'm not a fool until later. And what happened was I got sworn in Chicago, and I got drunk there at the hotel, and then I flew out here to California. And I ended up at Marine Corps Recruit Depot San Diego, and I'm sitting on that bus, and I'm cool, and I'm macho. And I got on my letter jacket, my white crew neck, and my flat top, and I'm a big deal, you see, and this guy gets on the bus, and he's got on a funny round hat, and he's got a shaved head. And, you know, I don't know how he picked me out of all those guys. I'm macho, you understand. I'm not a wimp like some of those guys I was with, but he picked me out, and he snatched me up by my jacket, and he threw me off that bus onto some yellow footprints, and he started calling me some dirty names and cussing at me. Names and cussing words that you people here in AA don't even use. And I felt inadequate and like a wimp. And I had to suck those feelings up, and I had to stick that chin out, and I had to act tough, and I had to act macho. And, you know, I was frightened, and I was scared, and I was full of fear, and I couldn't tell nobody that. I can't tell these guys. These guys are all older than me. These guys are all 19 and 20-year-old, and I admired them. And I wanted to be like those guys, so I sucked it up and acted tough. You know, I got through boot camp, and in October of 1962, I found myself on a ship leaving from Camp Pendleton, and we were headed down through the Panama Canal. And I'm going to go kill Cubans. Now, that's macho. I like that. You know, I seen John Wayne on the sands of Iwo Jima, and I'm on that ship going through the Panama Canal, and I'm scared because I'm going into combat, you understand? That's what I think. And I can't tell these Marines I'm going into combat with how frightened I am. How can I tell them that? So I'm sitting there on my rack, sharpening my bayonet. That's macho. And I'm full of fear, and I'm frightened. And I'm ashamed of those feelings, and I push those feelings down inside me. But some of my friends go break into the narcotics locker on that ship, and they bring me down a little morphine syrette. And I took the plastic cap off that morphine syrette, and I stuck that needle in my leg, and I squeezed that juice out. And the fear went away. And I went up on the deck of the ship that night, and I laid out there all night looking at the stars. And I wasn't afraid no more. And if you'd have walked up to me that night on that ship and said, "Hey, Jones, you know why you're not afraid anymore?" I'd have said, "Yeah, I know why. I know why. Because I grew up all of a sudden and I matured. That's why. And if you don't get out of my face, I'm going to break yours." I didn't know then what I know now. I didn't know that when Frank Jones ingested any type of narcotic into his system, it ripped that fear out of my stomach that I felt. It shut that head off that was talking to me, and it made me feel calm and cool, and I felt the way you looked. I didn't know that then. I didn't know that until I got here with you and you told me that. Now, you're not going to hear any more stories about any drug use because I didn't use any more narcotics. I look at it this way. Anybody can become addicted to heroin. All you got to do is shoot it. If you shoot it, you're going to become addicted. There ain't no social heroin users. If you snort coke, you're going to become addicted to it. There ain't no doubt. There ain't no social coke users. But if you're going to be an alcoholic, the way I'm an alcoholic, you got to hang in there for a long time. You got to be able to drink. You got to be able to drink. You got to be able to drink. You got to be able to wet your pants, crap your pants, abuse your family, lose jobs, alienate everybody around you for years to get here. And I did that one day at a time so I could be at this roundup. And I didn't use any more drugs, and I didn't get to kill any Cubans, and that upset me. I wanted to win the Medal of Honor and make my folks proud of me and make my girlfriend proud of me because I wanted to be macho. And what happened was we ended up going back through the canal. And then I ended up in the Far East, and we ended up in a place called Okinawa, and Vince spoke about that place, and that was a neat place. And the first night there, the guys come over, and they said, "Hey, Frank, let's go out and get drunk." And I said, "Let's go." Now, I didn't say, "Let's go out and have a highball, and I'll go back to the barracks and write Mom and Dad letters." They said, "Let's go get drunk." And that's what I did. I went out with those guys to get drunk, and that first night in Neville, we bought a Typhoon Fifth of sake, held about 2 gallons. It was about that big, cost 75 cents. We're standing out there in the ville, out there in these dirt streets, and these guys start passing that bottle around, and they're drinking it down, and everything, and that bottle gets to me, and I lift that bottle up, and I take 4 or 5 big mouthfuls, and I swallow it down. Now, sake tastes like Clorox. And I got to tell you this. I don't know what you did if you drank sake. I can tell you what I did with those macho guys I was standing with. I threw that crap back up. And my eyes are watering, and I got snot running out of my nose, and I'm trying to be macho. And I am feeling ashamed of myself and inadequate. And these guys are poking each other, pointing to me and laughing at me. And they're drinking it down. And it gets back to me, and I drink it and throw it up. And I drink it and throw it up. And that's what I tell you. You got to hang in. You can't let being embarrassed stop you. You've got to work at being a drunk. And I kept drinking it. And finally, I held enough of that sake down that something did happen to me. And I remember it very distinctly. I remember it very distinctly. As I got some of that sake down, I looked at those 5 or 6 guys I was standing there with. And I realized something. I realized that those guys were punks. And I didn't need them around me, man. They were wimps. And I took off onto the ville on my own. And I spent my whole paycheck that night on wine, women, and song. And I sit in that bar, and I started drinking Akadama wine, and I started drinking sake, and I started drinking beer. I ain't never been a social drinker. I don't know about these people that sit in the bars and stir their drinks and play with the olives and tap the fruit. I don't do that. Never did it. Never have, never will. And what happened was I sit in that bar, and a guy lift off from another battalion there. And you don't have to fight the Navy or the Army or the Air Force if you're in the Marine Corps. You can just fight anybody because that's what macho guys do. So I hit him in the face with a pool cue. Marine Corps frowns on that. And what happened was I picked this Nason up, and I gave her some money, and her and I went off to do what we had to do. And she went to get cleaned up, and when she left a little hooch there, I stole my money back and set her hooch on fire. I thought that was macho. And Marines do that. I seen that in the movies. And when I got back to the base that night and I passed out, and the next morning I got up, I couldn't remember anything. And the guys come up and they told me what I had done, and they started embellishing those stories. And I liked that recognition I got about drinking and fighting and the women and all that other stuff. But I had a terrible headache, and I was vomiting and throwing up, and my head was just ringing. And I couldn't shut my head off, and it was just going crazy. And when they told me what I had done, I felt that guilt. And I didn't know if that little girl, what happened to her or anything else, because I just didn't know because I had split when I set the hooch on fire, and I had these feelings that I couldn't cope with, but you know I found out a secret over. I went to my wall locker, and I got out a bottle of Akadama wine. And I found out that if I drank three or four big mouthfuls of Akadama wine, and I drank some water, something happened to me. That headache went away. My stomach ceased being upset, and it settled down. And my thought was, I was a big deal, and I was macho, and that's what was expected of me. And I became a morning drinker and a daily drinker at the age of 17. And booze was the answer for me. I could do anything, and booze would take the pain away. I could do anything or act any way, and if I felt ashamed, all I'd have to do is drink, and I didn't feel that pain anymore. And I could go on and continue to act the way I thought I should act. And what happened was, is the Marine Corps frowns on those type of actions, and I started getting office hours and court-martials. And I'd make PFC, and I'd lose it, and I'd make PFC, and I'd lose it. And I got enough PFC warrants at home to wallpaper my bedroom. And if you'd have walked up to me and said, Jones, you know what your problem is? Your problem is the drinking, man. I'd have told you, you're crazy. Drinking ain't got nothing to do with this. It's the company gunny, man. It's the CO. It's these people out here in the Ville. It's that other guy. He started it. And what I was doing was pointing a finger at everybody else. I never looked at me as being the problem until I got here with you people. I didn't know that I was the problem and that alcohol was a solution. I kept blaming everybody else. And they were the reason I was drinking. Hell, if they didn't act that way, I wouldn't drink. I didn't have a reason to drink. If you'd just leave me alone, if you'd stay out of my face, I wouldn't have to smack you. And that's how I thought about it. And I started hurting a lot of people over it because, like I say, I used bricks or clubs. It made me no difference. I developed the technique of ambush. It was great. I never got hurt if I hit you from behind. Never got hurt if I hit you with a jug about that size. And I didn't like pain, so I did that. And then the next morning, I'd feel bad, and I'd have to drink to take that shame away and that guilt and that remorse. And what happened was I ran out of money over it one day. And I didn't have any money to drink on, and I had to drink. And what happened was a cab was coming down the street, and I was starting to have a little bit of the shakes, and we stopped that cab, and me and my buddy was going to rob him, and I jerked that cab driver out of the cab, and I held his head down to the pavement, and I picked up the rock the size of a softball, and I beat that man's face in with it that day. And the Marine Corps really frowned on that. That was during Kennedy's People to People program. And that wasn't very people to people. And what happened was I had a general court-martial, and my father had to fly to Okinawa, and I was facing a lot of time because it was assault and intent to commit murder. And I begged the Marine Corps not to throw me out. It's the only thing I knew how to do. The only thing I'd ever been proud of in my life was that, and I felt like I fit over there. And I begged him not to throw me out, and my father brought letters from home, and he paid for that man's reconstructive surgery, and he paid for his medical bills and his retirement. And if he had come up and said, Jones, the reason you did that is you're drinking, I'd have told you drinking ain't got nothing to do with it. These guys keep overcharging us every time they take us someplace. They're ripping me off, and when I pawn my stuff, they don't give me the money that it's worth. And I just had reasons and excuses and everything else, and all what it was the alcohol. I had to have money to drink, and I didn't even know that then because I was always pointing the finger. What happened was is I was sentenced to 2 years confinement at hard labor and back to duty. And if you've ever been in the military, you know that can't happen. And if you spend more than 6 months, you're supposed to be discharged, and I had already spent a year locked up by the time all of this transpired. And when my paperwork got through, they let me out. And I was stationed at Camp Pendleton in California. And I met a girl and I married her. And what happened was I had to drink. And I drank and I drank, and when I was home and she run her mouth at me, I became violent at home and I became abusive. And I abused that woman. You know, I didn't know until I got here with you and that I talked to you and you showed me by your example. You know, I didn't know that she was an individual. I didn't know that she had the right to dress and act and be the person that she wanted to be. And I was trying to direct and control her and tell her how to act and what to say and what to do and how to clean that house. And then when she didn't do it right, I'd get crazy. And when I got crazy, I had to do things. And then when I did things, I had to drink. And then when I drank, I just to hell with it, I had to go out in the bars. And then you'd come up, and if you came up to me, I'd hit you. And then I felt bad and I drank, and I had to pick a woman up to validate my manhood because I was never enough. And then when I validated my manhood with another woman, I felt guilty. And then when I felt guilty, I had to drink. And then I'd go home and it'd start all over again, and I abused her, and we had a daughter. And then, kids ain't supposed to cry, and they're not supposed to make messes in their diaper, and they're not supposed to make messes in the house. And I didn't know that I wasn't mature enough to be a husband and a father. I didn't know that I didn't know how to treat a wife or a child, and I abused that family. And the only way to take the guilt and the shame and the feeling that I had away was to drink alcohol, and when I drank it, made it all right. And then I could go out in the bars and do that. And I run around fighting in the bars, and I started carrying a gun. You see, everybody frightened me. I didn't know that I was immature. And I did this for a long time, and just that cycle of drinking and carrying on and being crazy. And one day they called me into the CO's office, and they told me how macho and tough I was. And what they did was, is they issued me a rifle with a telescope on it. And they issued me some live ammunition and some hand grenades and stuff. And they sent me across the ocean to a little place called Vietnam. And I got to tell you this, long before I went over there, Vietnam is not my problem. It's not my problem today. It's never been my problem. My problem is I'm a drunk. I'm an alcoholic. And I drank alcoholically, and I was a morning drinker and a daily drinker 6 years before I ever went over there. So you're not going to hear me blame any of this on Vietnam. That is not my damn problem. But when I got over there and that airplane landed in Da Nang, I looked at those other Marines and I was filled with terror. I was filled with fear that I did not know how to operate. You see, I thought I was a big deal and I thought I was macho, but you see, I knew there was a war going on over there. I knew that people were dying over there, and I was so scared I couldn't tell anybody. I was so terrified I could hardly move, and I couldn't tell these guys that I was afraid. I'm going into combat with them. I'm not going to be in the rear with the gear. I'm not going to be doing some newspaper issuing supplies. I was a sniper, and I was attached up on a DMZ at Khe Sanh to recon. And I was going to be in the action, and I was absolutely terrified and immobilized by my fear. But you know what? I found out a secret over there. I found out that if I put 151 proof rum in my canteens, and I drank that, I became bulletproof and invisible. And it took that fear away. And what happened was we went up to Dong Hao, we flew up there, and then we went on up to Khe Sanh by truck convoy. And, you know, when we went out on the operations and we went out on patrols, all the things that you read about in Time Magazine and Newsweek, you see, I did those things. And all the killing and the maiming and the burning, I did that. And, you know, we'd come back in our harbor site at night or in the morning, and I'd start thinking about the things we had done the night before, and it couldn't register in my mind. You see, I couldn't justify that. You see, I wasn't raised to do those things. And I thought I was going to go mad, you see. My stomach was boiling all the time, and I felt a lot of pressure in my head. And all I had to do was take out my canteen and drink some whiskey, and you know, that fear went away. And what that fear did for me and that alcohol did for me was allow me to act the way I thought I had to act to validate my manhood and to be macho. You see, so I kept doing those things, and things got bad over there, and I'd done a lot of bad things. During March of 1968, during the siege at Khe Sanh, I got blown up, and I ended up back here in the States. And, you know, when I got home, I had a wife and I had a daughter that was 2 and a half now, and when I first went over, my wife was pregnant, and she had a son born to us while I was on Hill 881, and I hadn't seen that boy. But when I got home, I was stark raving crazy, and I had to drink a lot of whiskey, you see, because I had a lot of guilt and shame, and I'd done a lot of degrading things over there. And I couldn't tell anybody about that. And you see, I had to drink. And then when I drank, she'd get on my case. And when she got on my case, I had to lash out at her. And those kids were crying. And she was chipping her teeth at me one day. And I told her if she didn't shut up, I'd kill her. And she didn't believe me. And I went in the closet in the bedroom and got a gun. And I walked back out into that kitchen. And I was drinking whiskey out of the bottle. And I got to tell you that there was a God in that house that day. You see, I had quit believing in God a long time ago. Because you see, if there was a God, I had already broken all 10 of the commandments. And I knew that if there was a God, that I was screwed. I knew I was history. And I didn't believe in God. I wanted to see a Polaroid picture of him. I used to think that was a slick thing to say. And there was a God in that house that day, and I found out that since I've been here with you. And that God was looking out for me and those children and that wife. Because, you see, I tried to get the safety off of that gun. And I had a 2-and-a-half-year-old daughter hanging on one leg of my pants crying, telling me, "Don't shoot her, Mommy." And I had a little boy crying, trying to stand up on the other side. And that woman kept running her mouth, and I was going to kill her. And that safety wouldn't come off. And I hit the spring on the back, and I pushed that spring back in, and that gun went off. And that bullet went down and went through my hand and come out the other side and went down between my legs where those kids were standing. And that bullet didn't strike either one of them. And I got to tell you, I'm lucky for that, you see, because I could have killed one of those children. And there's no doubt in my mind today as I stand here, as drunk as I was, and as crazy as I was, that I'd have killed that woman that day. But there was a God in that house that didn't allow that to happen. And what happened was, is I ended up going on the drill field, and I became a drill instructor. And I was a liar and a cheat and a thief there, and I abused those recruits, and I'm not proud of that. But I had to do that. You see, I had to validate my manhood. And I had to act the way I thought I had to act, and I had to drink to take those feelings away. You know what happened shortly after I tried to shoot that woman? You're not going to believe this. She divorced me. Hell, that's not funny. That's sad. I only fired one shot. I didn't even fire the whole clip. She was a wimp. She took the kids and split, and I was resentful of that and hateful of that for a long time. She ran off with a state policeman from Indiana. made me brood. That's all right. I found another woman. You know how we are. This hall's full of them. Oh, I didn't mean that. But I found another woman, and I continued to fight and act crazy in the bars and abuse recruits, and I started still carrying a gun, and I was carrying a knife now, and I was just nuts, and finally I couldn't handle it in the States no more, and I wanted to die, and I didn't have the guts to kill myself, and I was starting to urinate a little blood now, and I was just crazy from my drinking, and I volunteered and went back to Vietnam. And what happened was, is I just wanted to die, and I wanted somebody else to kill me. I'd already lost all of my self-worth. And I got to tell you this, that the only reason that I bring Vietnam up is a lot of times when I talk, veterans come up to me after the meeting and they come up and they talk to me about this. And they say, man, I just can't stay sober. I'm having a hard time with this thing, man. I've done a lot of bad things over there. And I just can't stay sober. And I got to stand there and I got to tell them when I'm through talking, it's just my opinion, that there's a thing called the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I've read that book since I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous. And in that book, what that book tells me is that if I develop a spiritual concept of the AA program, and I find a higher power or a loving God, whatever I choose to call him, and that if I work the 12 steps, 12 traditions, and I get into action in the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, that I can stay sober no matter what. And it doesn't say in that book anywhere that if I've done a lot of bad things to a lot of people a lot of times, that you can't stay sober. That book doesn't say that. It says that if you do these things, and you apply these things to your life, and you try to change how you're living, and you go to meetings, you can stay sober no matter what. And I got to stand there and tell these veterans that if you're not staying sober, I think you're using Vietnam as a cop-out, and you don't want to stay sober. That doesn't make all of them very happy. But that's just my opinion. You see, Alcoholics Anonymous has worked for me, and I don't think anybody's done anything worse or anything better than I've done. I'm just a drunk, and I had to do the things I had to do to get here. And I've dealt with my problems about that with you people in here and a loving sponsor and a loving God and a lot of people. And I have done those fourth and fifth steps. So that's the only reason I bring it up. And in that second tour in Vietnam, a lot of bad things happened, and they got worse for me, and so did my actions. And I got to tell you how alcohol was still working for me. Alcohol was working and told me that these things weren't happening and that those were just the fortunes of war, and we were going to cross a river one day and we was going to do the things we had to do. And I had a radio man that couldn't swim, and he come up to me and he said, hey man, he said, I can't swim. I ain't going across the river with you, man. You're drunk and you're crazy. And I pointed my shotgun at him and told him if he didn't get in the boat, I'd kill him myself. And we went across that river that day, and we'd done those things that we had to do and that I had to do. And coming back across the river, I was in a blackout and that boat tipped over. And I had a hold of that man. And I come out of my blackout, and I was full of fear, and I was afraid. And I put my feet in his chest, and I kicked off of him. And I swam ashore, and when I looked back, he didn't come back to the surface. And, you know, I know that I was responsible for that man drowning that day. You see, I'm lifesaver qualified. And if I hadn't been drunk, I could have saved his life. And, you know, when I got out of that water, you know, I thought I was going to explode. I thought I was going to explode with the shame and the guilt that I felt, and I felt the pressure in my head. And I felt my guts were tearing apart. And the only thing that saved my life and my sanity that day was one of my squad leaders brought me a bottle of 10 High whiskey. And by the time I drank half of it, my head told me that that was the fortunes of war. And that that was his misfortune. And I hope that I never forget that. I hope that I never forget what alcohol used to do for me. You see, because I had no regard for human life whatsoever when I drank alcohol, because alcohol made it okay. What happened was I ended up getting shot up again, and I came back to the States, and, you know, I married that woman that I had met, and we had a daughter, and I started abusing that family. You see, I wasn't good enough or mature enough to be a father and a husband, and I had to drink, and I still had to go into bars and validate myself with other women, and I still had to be violent because I had a lot of shame, and I didn't want you close to me. And what happened was, is after 11 years, I drank myself out of the Marine Corps. You see, they wanted me to come back after lunch, and I couldn't do that. You see, because I had to drink and I had to gamble, and I couldn't come back. And I ended up out of the Marine Corps after 11 years. And if you're macho and tough the way I am, there's only one thing you can do. I strapped on a gun and a badge and became a cop in California. And I took that attitude out on the streets with me. And I worked graveyard, and I was terrified. I was afraid of the dark, and I was afraid of those dark alleys. You see, the ghosts of my past were out there. And all the things I had done and the people I abused were out there. And I had to drink before I went on duty, and I'm not proud of that. This is just what alcohol had to do to me to get me here with you people. And I quit asking a long time ago why I'm here and some other people aren't. You see, I'm here today because I'm supposed to be here today. That's the only thing I can come up with. But I couldn't tell my partner in that police car, I'm afraid, man. I'm afraid to go down these alleys. I'm afraid to work in the dark. And so I had to drink whiskey, and I abused a lot of people, and I was validating myself with other women and doing the things that I wasn't supposed to do, and I felt all that shame and guilt. And my police career come to an end. You see, I started having an affair with my partner. Now, don't get all excited. I'm not from Hollywood. I'm from Valencia. And my partner was a female. And she found out that I got my wife pregnant. And you know what that woman did? She shot me. That's not even funny. Only the Al-Anons were clapping. I can't even believe you're clapping and laughing. This is tragic. She damn near blew my head off. I have a finger you can lay in the part. There's a big gash out of my head. She almost killed me. Just because I got my wife pregnant? Jesus. That ended my police career. I got to tell you, I did the next thing that I think any alcoholic ought to do that's got a drinking problem. I got a real estate license. And I started selling real estate and drinking in the better bars. And I got to tell you this, that if you're sitting out there today and you think money, property, and prestige is the answer, if you think you had a little more money, if you had a house sitting on a quarter acre, and you had a new Cadillac in the...